Woo! Okay, well, while we get started, just give a general introduction to myself. So my name is Monica Ramirez Andriada. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Arizona in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science with a joint appointment in public health. So I'm an environmental health scientist. I look at environmental exposures and work with communities that neighbor hazardous waste. So today I'm going to give you a perspective very different from what you've currently been hearing. So one thing that's important to understand is that is looking at what translational science is. So David Augustine started to touch base on this, that brains aren't empty vessels that you pour knowledge in, right? You need to collaborate, learn about one another. And so in my work, I've been looking at and published on what does it look like to do environmental research translation. You need a transdisciplinary team. You need effective collaboration, information transfer, public participation, and a cultural model of risk communication, meaning that you're learning about your audience. Today I'm going to focus on briefly on transdisciplinary and then really hone in on public participation. So there's different types of research that exist. We have multidisciplinary research where you have multiple disciplines in their own silos doing the research, right? You have interdisciplinary research where you have multiple people working on research or disciplines, and then they might come together and try to integrate the data and information. And then what I'd like to hone in on is transdisciplinary research, where it's not even about the discipline. It's not about you. It's about the issue, right? It's about what are we trying to solve and who do we need at the table to solve that. That might be different disciplines academically. That might be different stakeholders. It could be industry, community. It can be a wide variety of people. But you need to think about who you need to actually solve the problem. So if we look at what public participation in scientific research means, it means it's intentional collaborations in which members of the public engage in the process of research to generate new science-based knowledge. Okay. This is where we think about, you might have heard words like participatory action research, community science. It's okay.
Okay.
Thank
sorry.
You. I'm going to rock out. Okay. You might volunteer monitoring, citizen science, right, is in the title of this talk, and so forth. So I just wanted to clear this, like, make sure everyone understood what we're talking about here today. And we have a wide and rich history of what public participation looks like. Prior to the professionalization of science in the late 19th century, nearly all of research was done by amateurs, meaning people who were not paid as scientists. Okay? So now if we look at what does that look like, right? We had Carl Linnaeus, who was collecting and doing some of the most interesting nature observations. We had, here we have Linnaeus and Ray, but regardless. And then we have Charles Peale, who developed the first natural history museum. And that whole natural history museum was built with items and pieces of nature collected by amateurs, collected by non-scientists, right? Charles Darwin exchanged 15,000 plus letters with 2,000 correspondents around the world to be able to truly understand the evolution and ecology of the world. We had Henry David Thoreau, who was documenting first flowering and leaf out dates and arrival of migratory birds, which is now called phenology. We have the volunteer weather observers. These are farmers and people across the country who were documenting changes in climate, and this is one of the best databases we have to understand climate change. And what you had is the National Science Foundation recognizing that people were, and we need to continue to foster public engagement in science. Here's just other examples of Cornell Laboratories with their looking at climate change and effects on breeding dates for certain birds. And then we have astronomy jumping in and getting in like Galaxy Zoo, where they have hundreds and thousands of images from Hubble Space Telescopes. And they're training amateurs how to identify galaxies. And so you have a high school science teacher who's published a paper in like physics today, right? And then you also have Globe at Night looking at Sky Globe. But we also see this type of evolution in the environmental health field. Okay, so we had John Snow, who kind of got on the ground and was really the first to understand what led to the cholera epidemic. Jane Addams, who worked with people, and Alice Hamilton, who was listening to the people on the ground, the people working in those spaces to understand environmental exposures. We had the Warburton activism. So I'm going through these just to set the stage that there is many examples of how you collaborate beyond your own like stakeholder to get to novel, interesting, important new data sets. So here's Love Canal. This is where Lois gives canvas neighborhoods to document the number of children who are born with different disease and malfunctions due to hazardous waste. Akwesane tribe and breast milk contamination. This woman coined her work barefoot epidemiology because she was trying to understand PCB exposures in families. The Louisiana Bucket Brigade, Public Lab, Leo, and what I'm going to talk about today is garden roots. So now we'll go into the gardens. But there's also a cool project where you can wear silicone bracelets to document your exposure to any volatile organic compounds throughout the environment. So in a nutshell, right, there's varying types of public participation in scientific research. I just showed you a whole suite from ecology, a whole set from environmental science or environmental health. But what you need to think about is members of their varying types, and the way that they vary is based on the role of the public. So you can have something that's much more, you can go with something here where, you can have a contractual agreement. That's where the community member, member of the public will say, hey, I have a question, do this research for me. You can have contributory, which was like the Hubble telescope. It's like they put data out there, they have you identify something and report back. It's one way. Birding, right? This is a lot of these are contributory style projects. And then you can see as you go to collaborative, co-created, there's much more engagement and collegials where the members of the public don't even need the actual paid scientists to do the work. And so here you can see just how those that I went over, where they fall, and where the work today, the Garden Roots falls. And so the question you should be asking if you're interested in starting public participation or citizen science is what are your stakeholders' goals and research needs, and what are the research interests of the team? You can consider, right, what the participant, what actually the context and construct of the participant itself. So how much is you can see here like a list of things of the degree of participation, depth of involvement, power allocation, the quality of participating in the project, and really what the quality, it describes the extent to which the project goals and activities align with, respond to, and are relevant to the needs and interests of the public participants. This is critical to understand if you're going to do this type of work. The other thing to understand is that the participants themselves are typically intrinsically motivated, and they're interested in contributing to science and stewardship. And these are just a couple things listed here, like satisfying personal learning goals, a co-author on a paper where we call this research altruism, people wanting to contribute to the greater good, and others who are trying to protect their own livelihoods due to environmental exposures. So there's many exciting outcomes. You can see here advancements in science. So you heard about a little bit about that from David. You can see the advancements in the individual, what do the participants gain? And then these socio-ecological benefits, which we can see are exciting to look at because they're talking about more public engagement, engagement in policy, and research management strategies. And so I'm just highlighting here that typically community-based monitoring and environmental justice projects start with this socio-ecological outcome in mind before they find out that the participatory approach is what that would be the most effective. Okay, so going back, so I'm from Tucson, Arizona. I'm second-generation Mexican-American. I love where I'm from, but we have a lot of mining. We have a lot of resource extraction activities. We have copper in our flag, you know. And here you can see what's going on within these mining communities is, or what's happening within Arizona, is this confluence of environmental issues. So if you look at the CDC map, that's the number of mine workers, right? And then if you go, you can see we have a high volume of mining. We can see that we have some naturally occurring arsenic in soils as well, which is also aggravated by human activity. And then you can see on the other side, the annual precipitation limited. And what we say PM10 non-attainment, it's meaning that we are not, there are areas within the state of Arizona where we're not meeting the Clean Air Act, right? Where there's exceedances in particulate matter of 10 microns or less in the air, which directly affects human health. And so this, I worked with a community called Dewey Humboldt, and they neighbored the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site. This is about 90 miles north of Phoenix, and what you see here in these images is, I'll give you a bird's eye view, is that we have a mine tailings pile. This is left over, basically you extract all the minerals of interest, you leave behind what you don't want, you have a pile, this is a legacy pile, high volumes of arsenic and lead that's prone to wind and water erosion. On the other side, you see this former smelter, again, high levels of arsenic lead, also some aluminum, and you see the residential area essentially sandwiched in between these two sources of waste. And then if you were there, you would see this like black slag pile as well as this orange pile. And so due to the occurrence at hazardous waste sites and toxicity, Arsenic is the number one contaminant of concern according to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. And this is a perfect example of why. And so you saw in Augustine's presentation that you see the circular diagrams and going into having a circular iterative pattern. Here's what I'm showing you, some of the things I focus on. But today I'll talk about engagement, including multiple forms of knowledge and data sharing. So working along the community at every step of the process. So here you can see generically the steps of the scientific method. Think about where the participants can be part of those steps. Right? The more you involve them, the more you're moving beyond just a simple contributory project and moving into a collaborative co-creation space. So here you can see that the question of study came from the community. We gathered resources and explanations, trainings occurred, the community members collected data, analyzed the samples, and also did some data validation, interpreting and disseminating results together. So let's jump right in. So here's the town. And they asked me at 2008, so talking going back, it takes a lot of time to do this work, right? Started in 2008, hit the ground in 2010, right? They asked, are my soils safe? Is it safe for me to consume vegetables from my garden? And if it is, how much? We're talking about a small rural community here, about 6,000 people, right? So what did I do? Like, I have an art background, I can design things. I'm like, all right, I'm going to design a manual, right? I'm going to think of, you know, what are ways for them to collect samples within their homes? General guidance was given, but they decided where to take soil samples for their native soils and their garden and which vegetables they wanted to have analyzed. I could have easily said, you're going to grow all of this, and I want you to report back the concentrations. But I wanted it to be culturally relevant and them to be part of the research. So they selected what they ate and what was meaningful to them. I'm not going to go through the data, and I'm going to go through process, keep it bird's eye view here. The next step is about reporting the data back. So actually, here's one data slide. I guess it can help it as a scientist, right? It can help. So here you can see this is the relative arsenic distribution to a participant the total average daily amount dose of arsenic and where it's coming from. So you can see right off the bat that like their arsenic risk and exposure was from water, soil, and homegrown vegetables. But you do see a case here right by the dotted line where somebody had incredibly elevated levels of arsenic in their soils, which led to incredibly a higher level in their foods, which led to incidental soil ingestion and plants contributing almost 80% of the arsenic to their daily diet. So what do you have to do with this, right? When you have this data, right, he was talking about, you heard, so I'm going back to our presenters because there's things that are great to hear, but they were talking about like, you know, you think about it, you're sitting with it, and you're like, I got to go publish this. But actually, I'm sitting here thinking about this, and I have to report it back. I have to report it back to those people that are living in that situation. They need the intervention and preventative advice, right? So what do? You describe what you found. You have an analysis and comparison. Is it high? Is it safe? Where should I focus my efforts on? And most importantly, what can or should I do? So by providing reduction and exposure reduction, precautionary strategies were provided. So one thing is I compared what these homegrown gardens, what these community members were growing to what they could get at the store. So that was a point of reference. The other thing is I gave them a booklet which showed them their arsenic concentration, but also other elements that might be of concern, as well as the nutritional contents of the vegetables, because people were worried that they'd stop even growing foods, right? And we want people to continue growing and eating fruits and vegetables. The cultural model of risk communication, right? So this is going into, you don't have to think about it in risk communication. You can just think about it in terms of communicating and working collaboratively. And so research communication should be tailored to the community members' need so they can make more informed decisions. So originally I started designing these data report backs that were showing them how much they could eat from their garden, assuming a excess cancer rate of 1 out of 100,000. So in our society, right, we set environmental, so when you look at maximum contaminant levels in your water, soil screening values, air quality values, those are decided based on balancing three things: health, technological feasibility, right, and economics. And so when you're thinking, so what we do is we have a risk society, right? We think about, so the government tries to keep our risk between 1 in 1 million and 1 out of 10,000. So I was like, okay, if I'm looking at that risk range for human population, and these are excess cancer cases above the existing risk of cancer in our society, I'm going to go right in the middle, and I'm going to say how much you can eat from your garden, how much kale you can have from your garden, and where you need to get your other food source. But there was something I realized when I did this. So this is data sharing, right? I'm deciding what, I decided the risk. I said 1 out of 100,000 would be great for you. So what I decided to do, so this is no one's real data, right, is to let them decide for themselves, like how much they want to consume from their own garden, right? So you can see if they're more risk adverse, they'll eat much less. When they're risk friendly, they might make some salsa for, they have 150 cups of like tomatoes that they can eat, right, in a week, and they might use that. So this was very important to show to them, providing them solutions. So I designed safe consumption of garden vegetables, how to prepare the garden to reduce the amount of arsenic and lead uptake into the edible portion of the plants, and safe gardening practices. I also explained how exposure assessments are done, right? So this is where I gave them all the numbers, and participants actually recalculated their exposure and risk by changing the variables that better suit their lives. So you can imagine when you do exposure assessment, you're assuming like you're going to eat a, I don't know, you're going to eat a 5 to 10 grams of radish every day. Maybe you'll go on vacation, 350 days out of the year you'll eat radish. And so people are like, I don't eat radish every day. So they could quickly modify this calculation to suit their lifestyle. So then I asked, like, does this work? Now that you have the results from your garden, right? So what I really wanted to make sure is that they understood their exposure, right? So if you remember that first graph, it was blue, it was water, right, was where they should invest most of their effort. Then it was incidental soil ingestion, right? And then it was the vegetables themselves. So I was happy to see is most of them would continue like they did before Garden Roots, but they changed their behavior. So this is where they would start to wash their vegetables more aggressively. They wouldn't eat or drink while they're gardening. They wouldn't bring their shoes in, right? They'd keep their gardening clothes outside. So it was great to actually document this behavior. They also started to ask great new questions. One person, we designed a whole study looking at chicken eggs. They were like, I have the data of the water, the soil, the plants that they're consuming. What about their eggs? Could their eggs have elevated levels of arsenic or lead in them? And so this is where we put together a little study together. But now I'm going to show you a little. So one of the things is like, how do you work through contentious or controversial issues? So here you can see, so this is concentration of arsenic in drinking water, right? So you guys aren't environmental health scientists, I don't expect you to know this, right? But the maximum contaminant level for arsenic in our drinking water is 10 micrograms per liter. You can see that more than half of these community members are exceeding the drinking water standard. Some of them are on private wells, so it's their responsibility to monitor and be in charge. But 3 out of the 4 of them were actually on the public water supply. This was a situation where participants had their data, right? They got that booklet. They worked together so this is why we'd share data and collaborate, right? They identified other households that were on the public water supply, and actually this project led to the notice of violation from the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality to that water provider for exceeding the drinking water standard. And here's looking at what does that look like. So a little timeline is that 2012, Garden Roots reveals that it's exceeding the drinking water standard. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is like, well, it's not related to the Superfund site, so that's not our issue. The State Department goes in, and it wasn't until 4 years later that the state actually got the water supplier into compliance. What I'm highlighting here is that since this was collaborative and the people already had their data, they were able to have it mitigate and had an intervention and actually address their exposures. This is a person's quote, but saying that they shouldn't have to pay for water that's not meeting drinking water standards. I'd like to highlight here that partnering and working together, so like I said, this is a small rural community. These are champions that wanted to address the environmental exposures within their communities. So you can see the father here, he raised the questions. He provided, I didn't even talk about a controlled greenhouse study that I did to look at uptake patterns. And then you see Rose Edemiller, who's a mother. She was a participant, also received a grant to oversee the cleanup at the site, and is a co-author on a paper and has presented with me 3 different places across the country in collaborative research projects. And so building on the successes of Garden Roots and a recent needs assessment, I've expanded Garden Roots to the entire state. This is where, again, if like best practices, you want to know what your constituents and your stakeholders need. So this is where I ask people, do you have any environmental health concerns? Is it just specific to this one community, or is this something that my state is worried about? And we can see here that they were worried about environmental quality and contamination. And so I've expanded Garden Roots to take place in Apache, Greenlee, and Cochise County. This is a bird's eye view of the Garden Roots process, which I've pretty much talked about, but you should see that step one is training and gathering the community members together to build social cohesion, community members collecting and submitting samples, analysis being conducted at the University of Arizona, and the result sharing. And so here is the numbers of participants in the future, and to learn more about this, you can see me tomorrow at 9:50. Okay, I'm just kidding. And so training depends on design. These are some other projects going on. We're just with training participants. They had a 1.5-hour training. So that was those home gardeners. But then I've done projects where I work with promotoras, community health workers, whereas I was training them to go train the houses. So that was a much more in-depth 40-hour. And then a new project, Project Harvest, is where it's community participants and the promotoras getting a total of 20 hours worth of training on how to train others collect environmental samples for analysis to determine exposure routes. And so concluding thoughts here is that I work to achieve environmental justice. When we have that, environmental health disparities will be reduced. And if you want to do this work, you have to have a good set of translational principles. You need to incorporate local-based knowledge, and you need to democratize science. Thank you very much.
We have about 2 minutes for questions.
Okay.
We have about 2 minutes for questions.
Yeah, so tomorrow I'll present a variety of different, like, how do you actually evaluate outcomes and needs. And so in this case, it was a purely a needs assessment. And so it was simple in the fact that it was short answer responses and yes or no. But when you're trying to do true evaluation of outcomes, that's where you can combine and do a mixed methods approach of quantitative and qualitative, which would mean pre and post surveys, semi-structured interviews, and focus groups are pretty critical. Yeah, so I see what you're going for. Your question is about, essentially, these were people who were intrinsically motivated to protect their health, right? They wanted to understand, they're very specific, can I grow my own food, can I start a farm here, versus if you're just trying to do, you know, increased stewardship versus an appreciation for soil health. And I would say that, you know, gardening's the number one hobby in America. People love understanding what they grow and having fun with that. It is a nice hub to engage and talk about soil health because, I mean, I didn't even talk about how many different extension agents and people I had come in and give talks about how do you get the best peppers and jalapenos, you know, or how do you get the best. And so I think going from their food, you know, and to then talking about soil health and how to fertility and whatnot, that works really well.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Great.